Well, under hot stories at coasttocoastam.com, NASA's sharpest-eyed orbiter at Mars has spotted the Spirit rover far below, sitting on a rock formation nicknamed Home Plate. Such imagery could provide new clues about the plateau's geological history and serve as a guide for Spirit's future moves around Home Plate. It's an incredible story, and you'll see a picture on the coasttocoastam.com website under Hot Stories. Mars orbiter spots rover on weird plateau. Little tiny rover, but it's there. It's there. In a moment, we're going to be talking about the universe, the electric universe, thunderbolts in the universe on Coast to Coast AM. Going to introduce you to two guests tonight. David Talbot is a comparative mythologist. He has devoted 35 years to examining the origins of ancient beliefs and symbolic traditions. He is the author of The Saturn Myth and co-author with Wallace Thornhill, whom you will meet in a second here, of Thunderbolts of the Gods. His reconstruction of the ancient sky was the subject of the feature documentary Remembering the End of the World. David Talbot. Hey, David, how are you? And welcome back to Coast.
Thank you very much, George, and thanks for the invite.
Oh, I'm looking forward to this. And Wallace Thornhill is an Australian physicist. His lifelong investigation of the electric universe offers a revolutionary view of solar system history, the nature of the sun, the behavior of comets, and stellar and galactic evolution. He is the co-author with David, as I mentioned, of Thunderbolts of the Gods and also the electric universe. Wallace, hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good, good. David, tell me a little bit how you and Wallace got together.
Oh, that's actually quite an interesting story because I first met Wall at a conference that my organization sponsored way back in 1974. And I then didn't see him afterwards. Well, we had shared an evening together at a banquet at the concluding event at this conference, and then I never saw him again until the mid-90s, and I had completely forgotten him. And then when we had a conference in the Portland area, I had gotten to know the work of Wall Thornhill and met him, and only later did he tell me that he was the fellow that I had sat through that evening banquet with 20 years earlier. Across from us was, very interestingly, David Morrison, who went on to become a very distinguished figure in NASA. David Morrison kind of signed up with the mainstream, and Wall and I converged from completely different vantage points. My mythological investigation and his study of the electric universe came together in the mid-90s, and we've been collaborating ever since.
Very good. You know, I spent an hour or so watching the video on the internet of Thunderbolts of the Gods, which was, by the way, very well done and extremely informative. I'm looking forward to this discussion with both of you tonight. You know, one of the things, of course, is late October, where the amateur astronomers were simply amazed when they saw this object that was so small originally, Comet Holmes, appear in the sky, got very bright. Full moon a few days ago kind of hid it from us for a while.
Yeah.
But an incredible story. Let's start with you on this, Wallace. What do you think happened to this comet?
Well, I think, George, that what happened was that it suddenly began discharging more strongly than it had in the past. When that happens, the first thing that occurs is a glow discharge. And because it's an electrical phenomenon around a tiny central object, it forms a giant sphere. And that sphere is glowing. So the brightness of the comet suddenly went from something that no one would notice in the sky to something that you could see easily with the naked eye. It brightened, I think, over a million times from what it was before. Now, this is easily explained in electrical terms, but in terms of material being outgassed from the tiny comet nucleus, first, you wouldn't expect it to form a neat sphere around the object, and second, you wouldn't expect it to be that bright.
The electrical event that seems to surround this comet, and we'll, of course, talk about what else is out there in the universe, then that's what you think is sparking this brightness, this glow all around it?
Yes, it seems that Comet Holmes must have struck a change in the solar wind environment, in other words, the electrical environment of the sun as it moves out to, past the planets. Sometimes it takes with it regions where there is either stronger charge or more dense solar wind, or the speed of the wind changes suddenly. It's these sudden changes which can give rise to an outburst from a comet.
David, could it have hit what some are talking about as dark matter?
That's right. I've seen that suggestion. And, of course, some had suggested that it hit a rock out there, which is highly implausible in that region. The issue with dark matter is so obscure. It's really reaching to excess. The problem for our standard theories of comets is that Holmes was moving far, far from the sun. It was moving away from the sun. Mm-hmm. It was out past the orbit of Mars. And in fact, it spends its time between the orbits of Mars and the sun. So there was no plausible...
Mars and Jupiter, David.
Hello?
Between Mars and Jupiter.
Mars and Jupiter.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, indeed. I don't even remember now what I said, but it must have been crazy. Okay, yes, that's where it spends its time. And that comet actually exploded into light in 1892 as well. So here's a very undistinguished comet that has brightened inexplicably twice. In 1892, when it brightened so surprisingly, it was out close to Jupiter's orbit. So the model of comets, which sees them as evaporating in the warmth of the sun, has not worked for Comet Holmes, and it has not worked for many other comets as well that have mysteriously disintegrated millions of miles from the sun or exhibited enigmatic outbursts as they are out as far as Saturn's orbit from the sun. There's a great mystery there.
What are some of the comets? I mean, physicist James McCanney believes that they may not be just all icy bodies. Some could be iron and rock. As well, both of you, you David and you Wallace, what do you think a comet might be?
Well, I think it's quite well established by the whole body of evidence, George, that we are already visiting comets that are rocky bodies. Mm-hmm. You see them very sharply.
Like an asteroid? Similar?
They're very similar. In fact, really indistinguishable from asteroids, except that they are moving through the electric field of the sun in a way that asteroids are not.
Okay.
So we're really at a critical juncture in the history of astronomy and cosmology, because in our view now, NASA scientists are going to meet up with a rock in space that is discharging electrically in a considerable cometary display. And in that one discovery, once it becomes undeniable that it is not an icy body, you will see a revolution in the view of the solar system, because that requires then an electric field of the sun. And if the electric field of the sun is strong enough at those distances to create a cometary display, then there is an electric field sufficient to light the sun. And that throws into doubt, then, the standard fusion model of the sun. That's like a series of dominoes, then, that reaches out to stellar formation and stellar evolution and so on.
So you're saying it may not be the sun alone that is creating this field, that the field may be in the universe.
The field is creating the sun.
Yes.
In truth, that's the electric model of the sun, and the sun is connected to galactic currents that are not visible streams of charged particles, But we are meeting up with electric fields in space everywhere we go, and the consequent magnetic fields pervade the universe. So this is the electric universe, and I am just proud to be aligned with Wal Thornhill, who has really pioneered an interdisciplinary vision of the electric universe.
Wallace, is this electric field, is it throughout the universe, or is it just in certain spots and areas?
The electric field tends to be concentrated in certain spots, and over large distances, it may be very weak. For instance, within the solar system, between the planets, the electric field is very weak. So we don't see cosmic rays striking the Earth from due to that electric field.
Okay.
But when you get very close to the sun, then you see the sort of energy that's involved in the electric field of the sun when you reach the corona, because the corona is millions of degrees in temperature, although using temperature as a measure of the energy there is actually incorrect. So, and the very fact that the comet itself was larger than the sun, that sphere that I mentioned earlier, that glowing sphere or coma, was actually larger than the sun. And this is typical of an electrical body in the universe, that it coats itself with a glowing sheath. So the actual sun, whatever it is, resides deep within that thing we call the sun. And what we're actually looking at is a huge electrical discharge.
If a spacecraft happened to hit one of these electric fields, what would happen to it, if anything?
It would depend on precisely which one it struck. If it struck one of the ones near the sun, it could be quite devastating to the electronics and so on board. And in fact, there have been occasions when spacecraft, like, for instance, the Galileo orbiter, when it was passing above Io, actually went through one of the so-called volcanic jets. Now, that is an electrical discharge. And it reset all the computers on board so that they missed getting some of the data that we would have liked. In fact, I warned beforehand that it was a very dangerous process, which may result in the spacecraft no longer functioning. But luckily, the ingenuity of the engineers was enough to allow them to recover from that.
Can you determine whether you're going into this field? I mean, do they know?
You can determine what's ahead of you to some degree by looking at the signals from radio waves emitted by the strong electric fields. And this is the kind of thing that one astronomer has done recently when looking at the so-called cosmic microwave background radiation, the WMAP information, and has shown that it actually comes from a network of electric currents flowing near the solar system. So it has nothing to do with the Big Bang.
Go ahead,
David. I think this whole question of electric fields in space needs to consider the weakness of the electric field as you would measure it across a short distance. And that's all that a probe could measure. So if you're just moving in deep space, well, let's just say between planets, for example,
okay.
the electric field of the sun, at any point, let's just say across a few meters, is so weak as to be immeasurable. But what you have to consider is the incredible volume across a billion miles of space and more. And when a comet is rushing in toward the sun at thousands of miles per hour, it cannot adjust to the charge differential. So it is experiencing an increasing stress. And stress reaches a certain point, and then it begins to discharge electrically.
Thunderbolts of the gods, are these charges, are they like lightning bolts? I mean, are they hitting comets at this incredible surge?
In the near vacuum of space, what you get glow discharge phenomena. And right at the nucleus of the comet, you see, or in the close approaches that have been made by certain spacecraft, you see little bright spots here and there, which have been unexplained. They, in my opinion, are the spots where an electric arc is actually eating away the surface and creating the jets.
And just hitting it.
They're actually easing it. It's a bit like an arc welding machine, if you like, and the material is being drawn from the comet nucleus into space by the electric guard.
Anyone can check out the Deep Impact site. This was in early July of 2005, and here a copper projectile was fired right into the nucleus of that comet, Comet Tempel 1, and it had a camera aboard. And as that camera approached the surface, you saw of increasing size these splotches of white. They were just whiteouts in the images. And this is really quite inexplicable, but that's what you would get with arcing going on the surface. And those splotches tended to be on the margins of cliffs, which is where, in electrical terms, you would expect the eating away of the surface to occur. So this has gotten almost no attention, but for a cosmic electrician, these pictures are the closest thing to a smoking gun of the electrical arcing on the surface of comets.
Will we ever be able to harness this field for either propulsion or energy?
That's a very difficult question because the energy is so diffuse. You almost need something like the size of a star to collect energy. But that doesn't mean that our ingenuity can't extend that far sometime in the future.
Wallace, what does this tell you about the universe, the mere fact that this exists?
Well, it tells me that science made one colossal mistake back at the beginning of the 20th century when it decided to ignore electricity, because up until the end of the 19th century, the Scientific American, Nature Journal, the science journals of the day ran many articles by scientists who said the consensus is that the sun is an electrical body and that comets are electrical bodies. But at the beginning of the 20th century, all of that was dumped unceremoniously. And when you think about it, it's the strangest thing to consider that electricity, which we find so useful in so many ways, is completely ignored by nature in the universe. So once you accept the idea that electricity is operating in the universe, everything becomes much simpler. And in fact, this is usually an indication that the science you're doing is on the right track, because about the 1920s, up to that point, things had become much more simple. The number of particles that were in existence at that time and were known were very simple. Our view of the universe was much simpler, but then after that time, science seems to have lost its way, and it actually revels in complexity now. You've only got to read the popular science journals to see the kind of science fiction nonsense that's published.
And David, what does this mean to us if science truly begins to understand this and begins to report on it more? Wow. What does that mean to us?
Let me just say, and we can get back to this at any point, that the signs are there that windows and the doors are opening to electricity in space. Very often it's more like a back door that you see the mainstream of science beginning to acknowledge the presence of electric fields and puzzle over the enigmas that they raise. But, George, that's the most fundamental point that we want to register with public imagination, and that is a vision of a universe that is connected electrically. And that means at the intergalactic level and down through stars and star formations and down to planets and on our own planet Earth, life itself. And there is a connectivity within the physical world that tended to be denied by the evolution of science in the 20th century. Electricity will restore that, but it also has a profound message for the evolution of Earth and the rise of civilization. Events that occurred in the ancient sky are the most powerful witnesses of all to the electric force. And this is the basis of the convergence that occurred between Wall Thornhill and myself. I had spent my life reconstructing these extraordinary formations seen in the ancient sky. And it was Wal Thornhill who spent 30 days in my office in late 96, early 97, and showed me beyond any reasonable doubt that what I had constructed were electric discharge configurations.
All right, let's talk about that relationship when we come back. After Dark Newsletter, you get 13 issues for the price of 12, and it is a great magazine tied into Coast to Coast. Lex Lonehood, webmaster, writes an article for it, and a number of other guests pop in and pop out as well. Call 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. David, the fact that we have this force in the universe, this electronic force, is this like, you know, the ability for all of us to do what we do? You know, consciousness allows us to communicate with each other, this intuitiveness, yeah. This power that we have within the universe. Is this part of it? Does this electricity help contribute to this ability?
You know what, George, I think Wall may be the best one to answer
right.
this. I can just say that from my own reading in recent years, I've been very impressed with the amount of attention being given to subtle energies, these having a strong electrical nuance to them. Subtle energies within the human organism and the relationship to communication between cells and subtle forms of communication or paranormal communication between human beings and the way in which animals and human beings are able to connect with the electromagnetic field of the Earth. I mean, this is a very large field that is opening up, and I suspect we're going to learn a lot more in coming years than we know today. But I know as well that Wall has very specific ideas about the relationship of electricity to life itself.
Okay.
The electricity of life is a subject of a forthcoming book on our part.
Give us your thoughts, Wallace.
Well, George, the electric universe tries to simplify things, and I think, as I said before, that's the way to go for the future. And in doing so, I came across the work of a chap in New York who'd independently worked his way through physics. He's a mathematician by training, and he'd come to the conclusion that all subatomic particles, all the bits that go to make up an atom, are actually made of smaller bits. And those smaller bits are charged particles, both positive and negative. With that very simple model, he was able to show how you could explain gravity in terms of the electrical nature of matter. And it also showed how biological molecules, for instance, could actually resonate with one another and transfer information. And then that led to the work of the cellular biologist, Bruce Lipton.
Right.
Who has shown that the intelligence of the cell lies at the cell wall, not in the nucleus. The nucleus and the DNA is more like a toolkit, but the real intelligence lies where you would expect it, where it interfaces with the outside world. So the cells of the body are actually in communication with chemical signals in the bloodstream, but also they appear to be connected to signals from outside the body, which gives the idea of an extended entity. Each of us actually extends beyond the body. And it raises all sorts of interesting and philosophical issues. But it also helps us to understand the things that are being discovered in the field of extrasensory perception, the way animals seem to be able to communicate without speech or any other visible means.
It's almost like a radio between each other or a wireless phone.
The interesting thing is that this means of communication operates at the subatomic level, and it's the same system that planets and stars and galaxies use to communicate the positions of the objects within them. Because if you think about it, our solar system, unless all of the planets and the sun know where each other is instantaneously, then the whole thing becomes incoherent and will fall apart in a very short period of time. And the same goes for galaxies. So these beautiful spiral galaxies we see in deep space are actually held there by the same force that allows biological systems to communicate with one another. So this is a really integrating picture that the electric universe brings to the whole subject.
Do you think, Wallace, it's intelligent?
My personal view is that the universe learns, and it learns from us, from what we do. So what we do does matter. We're not sitting on an isolated rock spinning around an insignificant star to no purpose. And I think that provides us with a new picture of our place in the universe, which is both much more hopeful than present cosmology allows, and also gives us a purpose, it seems to me. Now, if the universe is capable of learning, and I don't quite know how it does that, then it is capable of reproducing an enormous amount of information at any point in the universe that it is required. So I think this is why I expect we will find life in the universe wherever there is an opportunity for it to take root, because the information is already in the universe, which will allow it to be born in that circumstance.
What if, Wallace, the universe is alive? Maybe not like we biologically think being alive might be, but what if it is alive?
Well, as an interconnected entity, you could say that it is a living thing, because it seems to organize, which is something that dead things don't. Dead things decay and fall to pieces. But the universe appears to be able to organize systems of galaxies, planets, living creatures, and so on, which implies to me an intelligence.
David, you've looked at the origins of ancient beliefs and symbolic traditions for most
Many
of your
years.
Life.
Yes.
In the ancient times, did they know about this electric universe, these thunderbolts of the gods?
Great question. I don't think so in any sense that we would use, or by any definition we would use, but they definitely knew it in one sense. They observed it in a much more explicit way than we observe the electric universe today from such a distance. They saw the electric universe up close and personal, because they were the witnesses to stupendous electric discharging going on in the heavens. Now, this is a whole story that is so radically separate from the conventional view of planetary history. You sort of do have to start at the beginning. But my conclusion, after many years of comparing the themes from one culture to another and working only with the points of agreement between the different cultures, I found that by that methodology, it was possible to establish a reliable reconstruction as to what was seen. And what was seen were planets extremely close to the Earth, as extraordinary as that might appear to us.
And how close do you think?
Well, as close as the moon, and when you put Mars up there and Venus up there and Saturn up there, some of these as close as the moon.
Fully formed?
Yes.
Okay.
And of huge size. So this was a heaven-spanning congregation of planets in the most curious, the most extraordinary alignment with the Earth. None of this is believable when it is stated simply. But when people have had a chance to actually consider the systematic evidence that is available to us, and to see that this is simply working with the points of agreement between the different cultures, it becomes very convincing to folks. And I had the benefit of an inspiration from Emmanuel Velikovsky. It is my belief that the systematic evaluation of this historical evidence in the next few years will completely redeem Velikovsky.
Really? Because he was scoffed at. They laughed at him.
Absolutely so. And the best critics of Velikovsky today are the people in our circle. And they will tell you, George, that Velikovsky was wrong on many points. But what establishes Velikovsky as one of the great pioneers of the 20th century is the fundamental claims that he presented in his book Worlds in Collision in 1950 that are substantiated by massive additional research following the publication of that book. Very little of this has come into the public domain adequately, but it is headed in that direction. Amazing things are happening right now. I mean, at least six or seven people in our circle who have no appreciable record of publication in peer-reviewed journals are now appearing in a peer-reviewed journal, perhaps the most distinguished journal in its field, which is the Transactions on Plasma Science. And this includes Wall Thornhill and Professor Don Scott and plasma physicist C.J. Ransom and others that are an intimate part of our circle. So what I'm saying is that there is a historical reconstruction based on solid historical evidence, and it has met up with plasma science. And what is going on now is just extraordinary. There's an investigation involving dozens of professional and amateur researchers into rock art. And this was provoked originally by my communications to them. And it is demonstrating, even as we speak, that around the world, human beings carved onto stone images of these huge electrical formations in the sky, and global positioning and very careful observation of the lines of sight.
Like the aurora?
Pardon me?
Like the aurora?
Well, Tony Peratt, who is the spearhead of this particular study from Los Alamos Lab, he calls it an intense aurora. And he received his original inspiration in this study from communication from me. And it has taken over his life for 7 years. And there is a supercomputer running these images that has already demonstrated from different vantage points on the Earth that people were recording these extraordinary formations in the sky. The beauty of this is he has no interest in Velikovsky. He has no interest in planetary catastrophe. If we are incorrect in our reconstruction of that planetary configuration, it will be Peratt's group that shows we're incorrect. But I could not be more confident. And there are many, many reasons for that. There's much to come into the public domain in coming years. But this is an extraordinary time for us. That's what I'm saying. We did not dream 10 years ago that the kind of progress that has been made would be made. And this the material that is being investigated, is being brought together now, is definitive according to those who are looking at it. It is definitive. And Wall Thornhill has a major article in the very issue of Transactions on Plasma Science that I mentioned relating to stellar formation and supernovae. And it is a groundbreaking work. And it's getting a lot of attention from people now.
Velikovsky, of course, always believed that Venus was a captured comet.
Yes.
And is that part of his theory also that you
It
accept?
Is so much a part of theory. That's why you cannot escape Velikovsky. And there's just something so paradoxical about the situation right now. I'm working on a monograph with a fellow from Iowa, F. Cochran, editor of Eon, a Journal of Myth and Science. And it's called The Great Comet, Venus. It may take a year or two for this to get out.
That's amazing.
Lots on our plate.
I mean, they laughed at Velikovsky, David.
Exactly,
they put him
so,
down.
George, they laughed at him, and for reasons you can understand. How could a planet be a comet?
Yeah.
Escape velocity from an Earth-sized planet or a Venus-sized planet, they're very close, would be about 25,000 miles per hour. So they said, that's excluding any possibility that a planet could become a comet. But once you entertain the electric universe and you see that electric discharging is the source of comet activity or comet displays, it's a completely different ballgame. And Velikovsky had the insight not only to examine the historical evidence and see that every major culture on Earth was pointing to the comet Venus. But he realized that science, to deal with this historical evidence, must come to reckon with electromagnetic forces. That's what made Velikovsky's genius. And we have so many points in which we would not accept Velikovsky's reconstruction in detail. But anyone who was such a visionary as to discern in the ancient record the role of this comet Venus must be acknowledged. And I see this as a major front opening up in the next year or two, a real confrontation with science as we bring 34 to 40 years of rigorous examination of the historical evidence. We bring it to the scientific mainstream and ask them to challenge the conclusion that Venus did appear in the sky as the great comet.
If he was wrong on some things but right on a lot, why? Why didn't he get it all right?
Well, that's just not possible, I would say, George. But I mean, and he probably, if he were here, he would say, well, I did get it all right.
Exactly.
But the fact is, he was writing in 1950, and the pioneers never get everything right.
How did he come up with these theories?
Well, he was really pioneering a systematic comparative approach. The point is this. When different cultures in different parts of the world, using different symbols, different words, when they are defining the same phenomenon in the sky, in this case, it was the planet Venus appearing as a serpent, a long-haired star, a torch of the sky, a feathered serpent or streaming feathers, a bearded star, and so on. These are the hieroglyphs of the comet in the ancient world.
Right, all similar.
Yeah, different words, different symbols. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just that a strange myth got dispersed around the world. They were using a variety of comet hieroglyphs and attaching those to Venus. And that's only the beginning, because once you really delve deeply into these stories, you see, well, this is the same phenomenon.
It's incredible. Now, if I recall, didn't Velikovsky say this captured comet occurred 6,000 years ago?
No, actually, he was speaking of an event that he dated around 1500 BC.
Okay.
And he connected it to the Hebrew Exodus, and there is a scenario that plays
the great
out
flood.
In Close and Collision that I did not accept, and I didn't accept it because I was considering material that he had not accessed. And I was the first within the Velikovsky circles to say, now hold on, folks. This reconstruction by Velikovsky must be evaluated very carefully, and I feel that there are major mistakes in dating have been made. It's like themes of the great comet Venus in Worlds in Collision that he dates to 1500 BC. I was finding in the pyramid texts dated to 2600 BC. So that was just a fundamental issue that had to be addressed. Now, since then, everyone who's joined in this investigation has agreed that Velikovsky didn't get the specifics of that reconstruction correct, but that he nailed the comet Venus is the heart of the matter.
And Wallace, are you on the Velikovsky bandwagon here?
Well, he was the one who inspired me to the electrical nature of the solar system, and that was my interest.
So you're right there with him.
Oh, yes. He threw down the gauntlet to astronomers, and no one dared pick it up. Rather than do that, they just vilified him.
Did anybody do any investigating of Nikola Tesla and his thoughts of the electrical universe as well?
I think Nikola Tesla, it was another kind of intuitive genius in his approach to electricity and the electrification of the Earth and so on. The problem is to get hold of sufficient hard evidence from his work to be able to say exactly what he achieved. Some of the things he seems to have done almost intuitively without explaining how he got there. So there's a lot of work to be done, I think, in re-examining the experiments he performed and looking at it from the electric universe point of view to see if they're where the common elements are.
Well, fascinating. We're going to take this break, but we're going to come back with another hour of discussion with both of you, and then the third hour, actually, of the program with you, we'll take phone calls from so many people who already want to talk with both you, David, and you, Wallace, as well. Their website is thunderbolts.info, and also HOLOScience.com. Both of those websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about their work, Thunderbolts of the Gods, and also the Electric Universe. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with David Talbot and Wallace Thornhill on Coast to Coast AM.